Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with Luke Cresswell and Stephen McNicholas, the co-creators of the international percussion sensation Stomp, here at the ACT Geary Theater through Sunday. Also stopping by, choreographer Hope Moore and dance artist Sophia Wong to share details about the 2019 Bridge Project, which culminates this weekend after several months of work with Signals from the West, an international celebration of the 100th birthday of choreographer Merce Cunningham. From Bats Improv, I'll talk with music director Joshua Rule Brody and company members Dan O'Connor and Dave Dennison about the California Noir Off, a two-night festival of unscripted, improvised noir shows at the new Presidio Theater in tribute to Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, shares places to visit around the Bay Area during the month of November if you've got friends in town. Fine recommendations heading your way this hour. Plus, I think a ticket giveaway before the hour's up. Stay with us. Lots of rhythm, but no blues in store for you if you head over to the Geary Theater as Stomp, the international percussion sensation, plays at the ACT Geary Theater only through this Sunday. Stomp is a pretty phenomenal sensation. From its beginnings as a street performance in the UK, it's grown into an international sensation over the past 20 years, having performed in more than 50 countries and in front of more than 24 million people. It's created by Luke Cresswell and Stephen McNicholas, and it continues its phenomenal run with four, count them, four global productions, the ongoing sellout production at New York's Orpheum Theater, a permanent London company, and North American and European tours. Throughout its life, the show has continued to change by creating new material. Safe to say, you'll never look again at, so, let's see, supermarket carts, plumbing fixtures, paint cans, kitchen sinks, or Zippo lighters in the same way. Well, to talk about all of that are the aforementioned creators who I'm pleased to welcome to the studio. Stephen McNicholas is an English director, composer, actor, co-founder of Stomp. He's worked with a variety of theater companies, and his work in television includes Rowan Atkinson's Mr. Bean, various soundtrack work with Luke Cresswell and the Yes No video percussion series for ITV as director. He composed the score of the film, co-composed the score of the 1997 film Riot, and shares directorial credits with Cresswell on various Stomp-based short films and commercials. He co-wrote and co-directed the 2002 IMAX movie Pulse, a Stomp Odyssey, and the 3D movie Wild Ocean. He also composed and co-directed Pandemonium, the Lost and Found Orchestra. Steve, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you.
Co-creator Luke Cresswell, also in the studio, is a self-taught percussionist, one-time member of the British busking cabaret musical group Pookie Snackenberger. He writes music extensively for British TV and co-composed the score for the 1997 film Riot. With Stephen, he's directed the film Lynx for the 1994 Billboard Music Awards and directed three Target commercials for the U.S. Also with Stephen, he helped direct the HBO special Stomp Out Loud. Luke, welcome to you.
That was a mouthful, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. Congratulations. Well, let's first of all say 20 years of Stomp. Wow. Who'd have thunk it?
It's closer to 30, actually. It'll be 30 years in 21.
Wow. That's just amazing. And now I've only seen YouTube clips, so I'm looking forward to seeing the full production. And again, only a few more productions to catch it before it closes here in San Francisco on Sunday. Such amazing accolades the production has won, including an Olivier Award, a New York Obie Award, Drama Desk Award for Unique Theater Experience, special citation from Best Plays, among other awards. Take us back to the beginning, close to 30 years ago. Maybe you can start with that.
Steve? Well, in the beginning, we were part of, as you mentioned, we were a part of a busking group, which is a street performance group called Pookie Snackenberger.
I love that name.
Yeah, and
is that, I hope that's copyrighted because someone's going to take that away.
We stole it from somewhere. We didn't invent it. And we played regular instruments, but Luke was a percussionist, and he wanted to be mobile. You know, we didn't use a drum kit on the street, so to become mobile, he would strap drums to his body, or he would play anything that we found around us, and that we quickly discovered that audiences really like that.
Instead of traditional percussion instruments, which we'll see none of on the stage, is that correct?
Yeah, it's all about using your imagination and looking at things differently and playing things differently and how that playing leads to different choreographies. So it's a very interesting way of working.
Mm-hmm. So, but there's quite a leap from a multinational 50 touring groups from a street performance. So how did things get moved into a theatre situation?
I think we did it at the Edinburgh Festival in 1991, and it was really about putting a show together that we wanted to see. So it was never dreamed up to do some sort of world-conquering, you know, idea. It was a show that we would go to and something that we would enjoy doing.
We honestly thought it was way too eclectic for mainstream audiences, and it was that we'd probably be the only people. Well, Luke was in it, so I would probably be the only person watching it. so we didn't expect anything at all.
And a dog.
Yeah,
and a dog.
Yeah.
any livestock involved in the current production?
No. Not yet.
Not yet. Well, you know, yeah. You can get some interesting sounds from Zabin.
You certainly can.
Well, let's talk about, have you ever calculated how many total stompers there have been over the years?
Oh, no, we haven't, question. But we had a fantastic, in February this year, we celebrated the 25th year of New York and invited as many alumni stompers as possible, and we had the most amazing evening with, I don't know, hundreds of people turning up, and we managed to get 70 performers in rotation onto the one small stage at the Orpheum in one show, well, over two shows. And the stage only holds 300 people, this theatre. So it was fantastic evening.
Yeah, it's in the hundreds. But performers, when they join Stomp, quite often they join and they never want to leave.
I was going to ask, is there one that's been from the beginning, or who is the longest stomper?
The show's too old for someone to have been there from the beginning.
Yeah.
But there's people who've been
there. It's hard on the joints.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a rhythmic family. Once you leave, you don't leave.
All right, there has to be a story about the shortest cast member then, the shortest tenure cast member.
Oh, we've had a few of them. No, I don't know. I think, I mean, the average person would do the show at least 5, 6, 7 years, and some people do it for 20 years.
Well, I need to correct you there, because there's no average person in the show.
No. No,
because
true.
It's more than just being able to, use some sticks on a
sure.
drum. So talk to us about how the choreography evolved.
Well, I think it was always, because none of us were dancers, so it was always about being percussion, about being drummers. And so anything choreographic came out of get it literally going from A to B. You're playing this, or you're using your, if it's body percussions, how you move, how you get to somewhere. So it's always very individual. So, and the cast has always been very diverse. It's always been about characters and a lot of mad characters within that. So everyone moves very differently. Everyone does it in their own way.
Yeah.
So it was never about trying to be uniform in any sense.
We were certainly inspired by choreography that we'd seen. We were inspired by moments of Fred Astaire dancing with a broom, for example.
Sure, wonderful broom.
Fred Astaire
routine.
Kicking a drum kit with his feet. Those things were inspiration to us, but we weren't choreographers. We were musicians, so we applied the motions that you would make as a drummer or a percussionist. We applied that movement to the stage. So we were surprised when we would get bookings to play dance festivals, because we never considered ourselves as a dance show at all.
Interesting. So talk to us a little bit about the casting process. As I mentioned, it's not a matter of just being a good percussionist. You've got to have some great comedic timing. You've got to be able to learn some amazing routines as well.
Yeah. Well, when we audition, we hold open calls And what we do is we hold a workshop. So no one comes and does a set piece for us.
Right.
We just get everybody to do the same thing. We workshop pieces from the show. And we're just looking for the people that have a natural sense of rhythm, natural sense of humour, and a certain amount of charisma.
A sense of adventure.
Yeah.
So they've got to come in with an open mind. And, you know, they may have learnt lots of things in different stages. You know, they may be in a college to do dance or to do music or anything, but they should, you know, they have to throw that away and start from scratch to a certain extent.
Sure. We have a very important improv group coming on later this hour, so improvisation is also a very key element to becoming a Stomp member.
And I think with humour, we don't actually... generally look, people don't come and try and be funny. I think usually what happens is that we think they're funny trying to do Stomp, which is maybe not so good for them. And then we have to slowly break the news to them that they've got the job because they're slightly humorous when they try and do it.
Yeah. So are you two exclusively involved with the casting process, or you must have a team at this point of people that do some of the scouting?
We still do all the casting, but because it's an open call, so the last one we did would be New York, and we just put the call out and people turn up, and then they can come and have a go, and if it works, it works, and if it doesn't, they have a great time doing a workshop and learning how to do it.
I'm sure, yeah. So new routines are added periodically.
Mm-hmm.
You just see something on the street, say, oh, that might make an interesting sound. How do the new routines come into being?
Again, different ways. I was recently stuck at an airport for about 2 days, it felt like. And I was just watching everyone with the trolleys now on wheels being pulled and pushed and pulled and pushed. The suitcases.
Yeah.
And so we started to think about that and think about there's something within that that you can play with. I like doing things that the props that you use, people have access to all the time.
Mm.
So it's almost like something that you use every day, but you've never used it in this way.
And maybe dropping cell phones could be a routine.
I'd love to do that one, actually. Throw them quite hard at a wall. Would be
or smash them.
Maybe your friend's one that went off earlier would be quite good.
So from here, we don't need to rattle off the number of cities this has been into. What has been the most unusual venue that you've come across and reaction from a crowd? This is part of the Stomp experience is crowd reaction and participation too. Anything where it didn't quite click or?
No, they all click. My most favorite one was playing Ramallah in Palestine and an open air gig, which was just mind blowing. And taking something like Stomp to a place that never gets any theater really and seeing that reaction because it just blew people's minds. And that was fantastic.
Mm.
But then you have very different reactions. So a reaction in Mexico or Brazil is going to be really up and firing. They want to take over the show, you know. And then you go to somewhere more, you know, more Northern European, and it'll be a bit more regimental. And we must clap at the same time together. You know, and it changes. So I'm not going to say where, of course.
Yeah. any areas you're looking forward to as a new space or a new venue that you're coming into?
We're always looking. I think economics are so hard and getting, you know, I'd love to be able to pick up a much smaller size cast with less props and go to places that don't get theatre as much because it's getting a big show now. It's a big block to move around, you know, and so it's hard to get to places that don't have the money.
Mm.
I think that's what I'd like to do more of.
Right, and you're making some good money at this this endeavor as it is. We wish you another 30 years of it.
Thank you very much.
Again, the chance to catch Stomp at the ACT Geary Theater. Just a few more performances tonight at 7:30, tomorrow evening at 8, Saturday both a matinee and an evening show, as well as matinees on Sunday. Catch Stomp, act-sf.org. Steve McNicholas. Luke Cresswell, thanks so much for coming in today. We're going to go out with a little stomping music. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
One of the routines from Stomp you can catch on YouTube. Better yet, go to the ACT Geary Theater sometime between now and Sunday to catch them live. Amazing production. You'll see everything from Zippo lighters to the kitchen sink, literally performed on stage with some amazing routines by the company members of Stomp. ACT-SF.org for more information. Oh, well, dance of a different sort. Now, Hope More Dance presents the culmination of its 2019 Bridge Project, Signals from the West, Bay Area Artists in Conversation with Merce Cunningham at 100, tomorrow and Saturday at ODC. This 2019 edition of the Bridge Project is a bi-coastal collaboration and co-production with the Merce Cunningham Trust, ODC Theater, and the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art's Open Space as part of the international celebration of the Cunningham Centennial. Here to talk about the project and the amazing roster of collaborators that have been working together since August is the eponymous founder of Hope More Dance. Hope is a curator, choreographer, and writer who trained at the San Francisco Ballet School, studied theater at Yale, and earned a BA in Latin American Studies at Stanford. She worked as an AmeriCorps team leader in South Central LA, then moved to New York City to train on scholarship at the Merce Cunningham and Trisha Brown Studios. Her work reflects her passion for both community organizing and dance. Her signature curatorial platform, The Bridge Project, recruits the prime movers of postmodernism to the Bay Area to spark conversations that cross disciplines, geography, and perspective. Welcome back to our studios, Hope. So nice to have you.
So good to be here. Thank you.
Of course. You're joined by Sophia Wong, one of the collaborators. She's a dance and movement artist, writer, entrepreneur. She is co-founder of the Brontes Burnell Dance Company. With a PhD in English from UC Berkeley, she integrates her research and performance practices through writing and curation, focused on critical somatics, thinking with and as bodies. In 2018, Southern Exposure in San Francisco presented Wong's The Center of Emotion, Center for Emotional Materiality, a collaboration with multimedia artist Sarahi Sahaf, and which investigated digital technologies with a focus on artificial intelligence and its relationship to our bodies and emotions. Welcome to you, Sophia.
Thank you.
Of course. Well, let's first talk about the amazing legacy of Merce Cunningham, his impact on the world of dance and beyond. Considered one of the most influential choreographers of all time. Hope maybe you can give us a little Merce Cunningham 101.
Well, Cunningham is considered really a pioneer in his approach to composing dance in space and time. Whereas in more traditional forms of dance and performance, like ballet and opera, where, for example, the center of the space is where all the action is, for Cunningham, there was no center of attention. His work really leaves it up to the audience to decide where to focus their attention, and every part of the space is equally important. And he, in terms of physical vocabulary, took the technical rigor of the lower body in ballet and added a whole new lexicon of vocabulary in terms of torso and arms, and really invented a whole new lexicon for the body that became quite complicated, especially when he started using computers to help him compose. And he's also very well known for using chance procedures as a compositional method. And that aspect of the work was something that was transmitted to this group of artists involved in Signals from the West. So not only were they immersed in the physical practice, but they also received a lot of information about composing using chance procedures, which in a multidisciplinary context, as this project is, provides forms of entry, ways of entering and accessing the work to artists who don't have a movement practice.
Mm. We should remind people, too, that Merce Cunningham was a longtime collaborator with the great chance musician John Cage. We'll
yes.
hear some of his music in a little bit. So what I found interesting about this culmination of events this weekend is that you didn't know exactly what would be presented until very recently. These folks, this amazing roster of people have been collaborating in different ways since August, and even then they didn't know who they would be coordinating with. First of all, How were the people selected for the collaborations? And then tell us a little bit about what happened back in August.
Sure. So there are three co-curators involved in the project. Myself, Julie Potter, who directs ODC Theater, and Claudia LaRocco, who is in charge of SF MoMA's open space. And the three of us had a very lengthy, ongoing conversation over the course of several months to pull together a cohort of artists from many different disciplines, not just dance, many different communities, different ways of working, people we thought would be amenable to a collaborative, experimental environment. This project was, for everyone involved, a real experiment. The two artists who were representatives of the trust, Rashawn Mitchell and Silas Reiner, commented that they had no blueprint for a project such as this, namely in a multidisciplinary context where Cunningham's work was not being presented to repeat it or restage it, although that is a portion of the project, but really offered to these commissioned artists to do whatever they wanted with it. So what was the other part of your... what happened in August?
Yeah, yeah.
So in August, we had a two-week immersive residency for all of the commissioned artists. Every morning, the whole group shared a morning movement practice, and then afternoons were dedicated to looking at archival materials, video, and doing experiments with chance procedures, really talking about the ways in which Cunningham composed specific dances, and then inviting the artists to... make some of their own material in response.
Mm-hmm. Let's share with us some of Merce Cunningham's influence outside of the world of dance that were either presented or discovered by the artists and yourself in the process.
Well, maybe, Sophia, you could talk a little bit about that. He's also very well known for his approach to dance on film and dance for camera. And so he has had effects on the art world in terms of film, as well as music through John Cage, of course, and dance. So...
Sophie Wong, your knowledge of Merce Cunningham and how he's influenced your own work.
Sure. I was aware of Cunningham just as a fan of that work, and I actually, the first and only time I saw the Cunningham Company live was on their final tour in 2011 at the Zellerbach, and was, of course, struck by the virtuosity and iconic presentation of that work. And I've long been a fan, actually, of Charles Atlas, who's a longtime collaborator with Merce Cunningham. They made several dance films together, and they innovated a few things which you now see in dance films, and one of those is having the camera move quite actively along with the dancers. So I think there's this film, Locale, which was the first time that they made a film with the Steadicam, and it freed up the camera to move in and among the dancers and around them and to really arrange the viewer quite dynamically among the dancers. So it speaks to what Hope was mentioning before about Cunningham's approach to perspective being like a moving center and giving you a lot of choices in terms of focus and framing of the dance.
Mm-hmm. Can we speak of chance and improvisation in the same way, or are they considered apples and oranges?
I think
they're both fruit.
They're both fruit. I think they're very different. Chance procedures, at least in the Cunningham context, is refers to a set of methods that Cunningham used pretty much by himself to compose material even before he walked into rehearsal, which is very different than walking into rehearsal and asking dancers to improvise with some source material. So it's not improvisational. It's a roll of the dice. Although a question that really came up a lot in residency with the artists is how much room is there for dancer choice or artist choice when you are working within the constraints of a chance-based system.
Mm-hmm. Well, in addition to the premieres by these artists that have been collaborating and working together over the past few months, and those artists include Sofia Cordova, Max Crandall, Alex Escalante, Christy Funch, Julie Moon, Jenny Odell, Nicole Peisel, Danishta Rivero, Dazuan Solen and Sophia Wong. In addition to premieres by these people, you guys are going to be recreating or restaging sections from several iconic Cunningham works. Now, fortunately, I imagine that you would be able to recreate these because they've been filmed and recreated. is there anything that you're recreating that you weren't able to actually see to recreate?
No, the Cunningham Trust has a really extensive video archive, and all of the pieces that we will be restaging, excerpts from the dancers and Rashawn and Silas, the stagers, were referencing video constantly. However, in addition, both Rashawn and Silas had performed these works, so the information was in their bodies. So they were transmitting body to body, as well as using archival material to supplement the transmission.
Mm-hmm. Great. And I should also mention that on the 9th, which is Saturday, there will also be a pre-show, which is called a haptic tour and live audio description that starts at 7 p.m. Tell us about that, Bill.
Yeah, this is a really interesting kind of new service that's being provided by Jess Curtis's Gravity, allowing blind and visually impaired people to experience the performance through what's called live audio description. So there will be someone sitting in the back of the theater describing the performance in real time, and the blind and visually impaired folks will have headsets on, so they'll be hearing a real-time translation of what's happening on stage. And the pre-show haptic tour is an opportunity for those folks to meet some of the performers, maybe touch some props, get a sense of the space through other senses other than visual.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And Sophia, tell us a little bit about what we'll see on your with your work.
Sure. So I made a short dance for camera inspired by Atlas's collaborations with Cunningham. And we looked to a few films as references. I was inspired by a film called Locale, a film called Coast Zone, and the way that Atlas and Cunningham were playing with deep foreground, deep background, deep focus. So I worked with a few collaborators. I worked with Brontez Purnell, my dance partner, Chani Bockwinkle, who is a dancer and filmmaker, Lisa Rybovich-Crawley, who is a visual artist, and Kim West, who's a musician. I should also say that another strong reference point for this project is Atlas's film Hail the New Puritan, which she actually worked on with the Michael Clark Dance Company. I really loved the post-punk and pop aesthetic of that project. So you'll see all of that in a very intensive 5.5-minute film.
Wow. It sounds like a great couple of evenings culminating this fantastic project, the Signals from the West Bay Area Artists in Conversation with Merce Cunningham at 100hopemore.org for more information. Hope, Sophia Wong, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you.
We should mention that it's tonight at 7 p.m. in a conversation with Rashawn Mitchell will happen. And then tomorrow, the culminating work, tomorrow and Saturday, 8 p.m. both days, the culminating works of this amazing collaboration at the ODC Theater, which is at 3153 17th Street here in San Francisco. And we're going to go out with the music of John Cage, the longtime collaborator with Merce Cunningham. And this is part of his Roratorio from 1979. Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.
This is the grandma. This is the hour.
A touch of John Cage, who was speaker in that excerpt from his 1979 Roratorio, an Irish circus on Finnegan's Wake, Horsespiel, a radio play for electronic tapes, speaker, and Irish folk musicians. may hear some of that as part of the Hope More project that's happening this weekend as a culmination and tribute to Merce Cunningham at 100. A very good afternoon to you. Once again, I'm David LaTulipe. Before the hour is up, you'll get some recommendations if you've got some friends in town for what to do here in the Bay Area to show them the wonderful things around us, including some hiking suggestions and a visit to the Rosie the Riveter display in Richmond. Well, for something unusual, and speaking of improv and chance, you can join Bats Improv tonight and tomorrow evening for the California Noir Off at the new Presidio Theater in anyone? That's right, the Presidio Theater, brand new. Two of the premier practitioners of full-length improvised plays pay tribute to the godfathers of California noir, Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, in a two-night festival of unscripted noir. Improv Theater from Los Angeles reunites with the company that spawned it, Bats Improv, for a split bill of dames, detectives, and double crosses. Friday night, they face off as the San Francisco team fashions a spontaneous homage to Hammett and L.A. improvises in the style of Chandler. Both companies will join forces Saturday night for an improvised noir musical directed by Joshua Raul Brody, who joins me in studio. Joshua is best known for his work providing musical accompaniment for improvisational theater. He's been music director for Bats Improv almost since its inception, was a founding member of True Fiction Magazine and Pulp Playhouse, and has also worked with many other groups. Aside from improv, he's worked with Merle Ian Scholes Kessler on several one-man shows, is a member of the Quartet Tango No. 9, and the medium-sized big band Orchestra Nostalgico. He's a fine accompanist as well, and has worked with legends Nina Hagen and Florence Henderson, among others. Joshua, welcome back to our studios.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Of course. Let me get your correct mic on. You can say that again.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Yeah, that's
more time?
There we go.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Speaking of improv, it's improvisational live radio here. Dan O'Connor, co-founder and producing artistic director of Impro Theater, as well as a co-founder of Los Angeles Theater Sports and Bats Improv here in San Francisco. Actor, writer, director, producer, and improviser. Television directing credits include shows for ABC and the Oxygen Network. He co-created the NBC TV improv show World Cup Comedy, which ran for two seasons on PAX, and has a long list of TV acting credits, including Seinfeld, Malcolm in the Middle, as well as The Tonight Show and Law and Order LA, among others. He's worked with ACT here in San Francisco, Shakespeare Santa Cruz, and The Taper 2, and has coached several Cirque du Soleil productions. And his book, Life Unscripted, is being published. Dan, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks for having us, David.
Dave Dennison's been on Open Air before. He's been a company member of BAT since 1998 and a coach since 2004. Describes improvised theater as his first love and developed the improv format Family Drama at Bats Improv, and for more than 10 years, it's been an audience and player favorite. He's performed with many groups, including True Fiction Magazine, Scratch Theater, Start Trekkin', The Particulars, Secret Improv Society, among many others, and from 2005 to 2008, he served as artistic director of Bats. Dave, welcome back to Open Air.
Thank you for having us, David.
Of course, happy to have you. Well, let's talk about the inspiration for this Noir Off. Who wants to handle that? Dan? Jen's looking at Joshua. Joshua's looking at Dan.
Well, Brian Lohman, who is the director for the L.A. Noir Unscripted, our show down in L.A., who's also a founding member of BATS, up here. I guess spoke with Rafe Chase, who's directing the show up here, the Hammett show, and also Joshua. And we came up with this amalgam of doing Chandler, Hammett, and also an improvised musical. So Friday night will be the BATS company doing Hammett and the L.A. Impro company doing Chandler. And then the second night we're improvising a full-length musical in the style of noir.
I think another element was that Brian was talking to our old friend Bob Martin, who used to be the artistic director at the Cowell Theater and is now bringing into existence the new Presidio Theater, a fabulous 600-seat theater in the Presidio, not to be confused with the cinema on Chestnut Street. Mm-hmm. This is in the Presidio proper, and it's spelled theater with an R-E.
And Bob wanted to, is trying to recreate his eclectic booking policy that he had at the Cowell. And this is fitting in with his vast vision.
It's a nice venue. I went to the opening. It's really going to be quite a welcome addition to the whole performing arts scene here.
It's 600 seats, and it's still intimate. There's not a bad seat in the house. The sound is fantastic, and it's state-of-the-art equipment. It's going to be really great.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the focus and the fundamental premise of BATS, and how there's got to be stories where things didn't quite go as planned. And the thing is, things are not supposed to be planned. So how do you get out of a box that you might have improvised your way into? Maybe Dave can help us with that one.
Well,
or is there always a way out of the box?
I would say yes, there's always a way out of the box. And I think that when we improvise, we're expecting that something will go off. Not that we set out to do that. We actually set out to maybe have things run smoothly. But we also know that from experience and from doing so many shows that we've been in this situation before. And actually, it's very compelling for an audience when they see these things happen. And if we can respond with good humor and whatever resolution comes out of it, they will love if they sense that we're okay in being in that place.
Spike Milligan, who is the leader of the English comedy group The Goons, his famous line is, "We have no plan, therefore nothing can go wrong."
And that's true. I mean, some of the best shows I think any of us have been involved in have been when things have gone completely wrong. We had a Shakespeare show in L.A. during an earthquake. The lighting began to swing over the audience's head, and the actors on stage used it to, "The earth doth move beneath my feet, Melinda, and I do feel my body roil and quake." So mistakes are gifts in what we do, and when we paint ourselves into a box, it, as Dave said, it's compelling for the audience because they're viscerally connected to what we're doing because they gave us the suggestions. They're stakeholders in the show, so seeing us make our way through using whatever the mistake is compelling and visceral theater.
Talk to us a little bit about the audience participation factor then, and will that be an element this weekend?
It probably won't be as constant an element as it is in our short form shows. Listeners that are new to improv might be familiar with short form from the TV show Whose Line Is It Anyway, where improvisers do short scenes basically based on a gimmick or a game. Long form is a full-length show, and Friday night it'll be 2 one-act plays, and Saturday it'll be 1 two-act show. And to get things started, we may get a couple of elements, a title, occupation. We haven't actually worked out exactly what the gets are going to be, mm-hmm. but those will be used as the trigger to get the show going, and probably not a whole lot will be gotten from the audience after that, but you never know.
Please, Dave.
Oh, I would say that the audience is involved because we know when we're performing on stage that we're creating something that exists in their imagination. It exists in our imagination as well. And so even when we're not getting suggestions from them, the life of the story that we're creating it's hanging somewhere in the air between our collective imaginations. So.
Mm-hmm. Dan O'Connor, you helped found BATS Improv here in San Francisco and then went on to L.A. to create your own version of it down there. Let's talk a little bit about the differences between actors up in L.A., down in L.A. versus San Francisco. I'm dying for some dirt.
Where do I begin, David? No, it's I don't think, I mean, the BATS and Impro Theater are very, very much connected. LA Theater Sports was started by a legion of San Francisco expats way back when. So we have a very, we can draw a line straight up to San Francisco. In fact, we also have a great deal of Seattle influence. And the founder, the teaching, Rebecca Stockley, taught the very first class that became BATS. And she came down from Seattle, and Bob Martin was part of that.
That's true.
Yeah, but the difference, I don't know if there's a great deal of difference in the level of talent, but there is in just where we are location-wise and how our audiences in L.A., Impro Theater basically tours L.A. County, and we do venues as small as 40 seats, and we've played it. We did Noir in a 1,200-seat amphitheater at the Ford Amphitheater with a full jazz band. So it's very different as opposed to Bats having their lovely theater down in Fort Mason, which, you know, they have consistency, whereas we're still vagabonds moving around L.A. County and around the country as well.
Mm. Well, let's turn to the music end of things with this amazing Renaissance man we have with us, Joshua Roll Brody, who's a good friend of KLW. And I should give a shout-out that Sarah Cahill was just in Sends Her Love.
Oh, back up at her.
So talk to us about the music that will be involved.
On Friday night, I will be providing instrumental underscore, trying to recreate the style of noir cinema. I'm not exactly a 40-piece orchestra, but I do the best I can with a couple of keyboards and some sound effects. Saturday night, the musical will have not just underscore for the spoken word scenes, but also moments where the actors will step forward and sing their inner thoughts, and those songs will also be completely improvised.
What? Mm-hmm. No, there's a phone call.
The actors will be singing their completely improvised songs, the lyrics and music both.
Oh, fantastic. That's great. You brought with us, brought to the studio, your fairly recent CD, Orchestra Nostalgico. Tell us about the group.
It grew out of Clubfoot Orchestra, which is best known for its work accompanying silent films. But in the late 80s, early 90s, I got a residency at Bruno's on Mission Street. The owner of that club commissioned Matt Brubeck, who was a member of the group at the time, to put together a tribute to Nino Rota, the composer of Fellini's films. Mm. And Matt enlisted most of the people in Clubfoot at the time. And we were there every week for many, many months. Did one album of all Nino Rota music. Mm-hmm. And then the group evolved. Matt moved to Canada. And the current group is called Orchestra Nostalgico and does film music from many composers.
Right.
Bernard Herrmann, John Barry from the James Bond films, Lennon and McCartney, perhaps you've heard.
Mm, indeed. Hearing a little bit of Bernard Herrmann from that CD in the background as we conclude this segment. Dan, how many folks from L.A. are coming up to be a part of this, and what's the total of personnel that we'll see on stage this weekend?
Well, there's I think five of us. Five of us? Five of us coming up from L.A. To do the show, and we couldn't be more excited. The fact that Bob Hope and Jack Benny and any number of other people have been on that stage, I think we can't help but have a good time. So.
Right, indeed. Well, Friday, Bats Improv presents a fully improvised one-act noir in the style of Dashiell Hammett. L.A.'s Impro Theater presents a fully improvised one-act noir in the style of Raymond Chandler, directed by Brian Lohman. That's tomorrow night. Saturday, a fully improvised two-act musical noir featuring cast members from both companies and directed by Joshua Roll Brody. Dave, Dan, Joshua, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us, David.
Thank you, David.
For more information for these performances, go to improv.org or check out all the happenings at the brand new Presidio Theater at Presidio Theater, that's theater with an R-E, .org. Music of Orchestra Nostalgico and the music of Bernard Herrmann to take things out. Thank you. Well, this is a time of year where we often have guests visiting. Peter Robinson on hand to offer some suggestions. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Yes, good to be here. And I was thinking today when you came in, or I came in on the ferry from Marin, that it is a type of Indian summer. For the rest of the country, it may be November, may even be snow, sleet. Here we have sunshine. So November is actually quite a good month if you have friends visiting San Francisco. Prices are a little cheaper. It's a changeover period. So here's a couple of activities which I think would appeal both to local residents but also to outsiders. And the first is to take a trip out to Richmond to a museum. The museum is actually called Rosie the Riveter. It's a tribute to World War II and how people really came together in what I'm going to call the shipbuilding industry. Now, this is part of a national park, and it operates on two floors. I would suggest going downstairs to start with, where you'll catch a really interesting documentary about how the town employed women, employed all levels of immigrants in what I've described as a rapid shipbuilding industry. Because a lot of these ships were pre-assembled, they could make a full vessel in 3 days. Now, think about that today, how long it takes to get something on the water. The museum has a number of guides, so you can call in ahead of time and see if you want to get a talk about why this town was so important. And I think what you do get is the spirit of community. Today, in our era, we're talking about divided communities, people who disagree on almost every subject. Suddenly you get an outside threat, the threat being World War II and the common enemy, and suddenly people come together. The other thing I'd recommend if you're going down to Richmond is there is a beautiful walk, takes you straight onto the water, and there are also grounds for a picnic. So if you want to bring the family and enjoy the outdoors, that too is something in November I would recommend. If you're into dining, the little restaurant next door called The Assembly does a very reasonable meal. So put Rosie the Riveter on your list, a tribute to World War II and the home front during those difficult years between 1940 and 1945. Now, focusing on a couple of the other outdoor activities is something which this area is well known for, and that is whale watching. And this time we can head out to Point Reyes. If you don't want to get in a vessel which actually does the whale watching, bring a pair of binoculars. And a couple of interesting things of Point Reyes. First, starting this week, they've finished the renovations at Point Reyes Lighthouse. And so that is a little architectural trip. Secondly, there are a number of interesting trails. My favourite is the Burr Trail. You won't see any burrs, but you will see lots of wildlife and interesting nature. And then finally, for me, harking back to the old country, the Drake's Bay. They called it Drake's Bay because of the white cliffs. And, of course, Drake, on his circumnavigation, supposedly landed and was met by the Miwoks in 1576. So you've got a lot of history in Point Reyes. You've got a lot of nature. And on a good day, you may even see the humpback whale. I want to say humping, but at least coming bang out of the water, because this is the humpback whaling season. Then finally, heading back into the city, again, it's in Marin, but it's an interesting segment to go to Tiburon. Tiburon's worth having a walk around, and then they have a 10-minute ferry which will take you to Angel Island. And although people have their own choices, I always put Angel Island ahead of Alcatraz, and I do it for three reasons. It's a beautiful hike. If you stick on the perimeter trail, it'll take you about 2.5 hours at a reasonably paced walk. It's really a photographer's paradise because you can get magnificent panoramic views of the city, of the East Bay, and then as you look to the west, the rising sun behind Mount Tam, and then down to the bay to the Golden Gate Bridge. So you've got multiple viewpoints just on the outside walk. From a historian's point of view, when you get off the boat, the quarantine centre for Chinese immigrants coming in at the end of the 19th century, it was a place that they were held. And on the walls are poems, graffiti poems, other poems written as they stayed there. So suddenly you're taking San Francisco's history back to after the gold rush and how immigrants were treated in what could be the West Coast equivalent of Ellis Island. Then as you continue your journey around Angel Island, stop at the officers' quarters which were actually set up during the Civil War, although California was not involved in the Civil War, and you'll see a little museum there that takes you back to the 1850s. Continue your trip around and you suddenly discover the Miwok missile sites, holes in the ground where during the Cold War these particular segments were our protection against potential invaders. And then finally, for those who are truly energetic, a two-hour hike up to the top, and you may even catch the famous white goats, which are part of, again, that setup. So think of November as something slightly different. It begins with Remembrance Day, and of course the Day of the Dead. It finishes with Thanksgiving. But in between are all these truly interesting little pieces of history, little pieces of nature, and indeed, using the sea, the ferry, bringing everything together, which I think is what makes California and the Bay Area such a glorious state. So the three suggestions just to finish with, in case you want to jot them down. First, consider a trip out to Rosie the Riveter, the World War II museum out at Point Richmond. Secondly, take a trip over to Point Reyes. Inspect the lighthouse, look out for the whales. And finally, as you drive back, stop off at Tiburon, hop on the ferry, and suddenly you're on Angel Island. That's why we all live here, and that's why it's November in San Francisco.
Fine suggestions all, and a fine time to visit our fair city and environs. Thank you so much, Peter.
Keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage, sitting up there on the fuselage. That little frail can do more than a male can do. Rosie the Riveter. Rosie's got a boyfriend, Charlie, he's a Marine. Rosie is protecting Charlie, working overtime on the riveting machine. When they gave her a production knee, she was as proud as a girl could be. There's something true about red, white, and blue about Rosie the Riveter.
RosieTheRiveter.org for more information about the Rosie the Riveter Trust. Well, a number of other things are happening here in the Bay Area this weekend, including the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony performing, of which I am a proud member. Norman Gamboa is our guest conductor this Saturday evening for our winter concert. Samuel Barber's Essay Number 1 on the program. Kyle Kindred's Flute Concerto with our principal flutist, Linda Watkins, featured as soloist, and Manuel De Falla's Three-Cornered Hat ballet music, which we're hearing in the background. KLW is pleased to present three pairs of complimentary tickets to those that call 415-841-4134 for the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony this Saturday evening, 8 o'clock at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. 415-841-4134. Music of Barber, De Falla, and Kyle Kindred on the program. Also this weekend, well, tomorrow opens the production of Manon Lescaut at the San Francisco Opera for six performances. sfopera.org for more information. And the San Francisco Symphony is pleased to present guest conductor Ton Koopman in works of Bach, Haydn, and the Bach contemporary Jean-Ferry Rebel. I had no idea of that contemporary of Bach. Quite a prolific composer. He will hear his Chaos from a work that he composed. Ton Koopman on the podium tomorrow and Saturday evening at 8 p.m. at the San Francisco Symphony. We do have tickets for the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, if you'd rather, nearby at the San Francisco Conservatory, 415-841-4134 for a pair of complimentary tickets to that performance Saturday at 8. Next week on Open Air, more noir. We'll have Don Malcolm, the curator-programmer for The French Had a Name for It, the 6th annual French film noir series being held at the Roxy Theater. A couple of music directors will also be on hand from Symphony Caritas. We'll talk with music director Paul Schrag about the ensemble's benefit concert for the Gubbio project. And conductor Daniel Stewart, who was recently named the San Francisco Symphony resident conductor for the San Francisco Youth Symphony, will be on hand to talk about his work here in San Francisco and in Santa Cruz. And I'll also talk with cast members from the world premiere of Test Match at the ACT Strand Theater. Join me next week for Open Air right here on KALW. I'm David Latuli. Thanks so much for listening to this week's show. A reminder that the shows are archived at kalw.org. Thanks to Niels Swinkels for producing the show. If you've got a segment suggestion, by all means, dash me an email, david@kalw.org. Thanks so much for listening.